on the substance of the case we're about to hear, and you will probably be joined by students who came to the 9:45 oral argument. I'd like to introduce the court to all of you. On my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Bablich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you will meet today at noon. And on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. With these introductions made, we will call the second case, 01-2432, Fireman's Fund Insurance Company versus Bradley Corporation. Attorney Thomas Schreiner, Jr., Foley and Lardner, presenting the case for Bradley Corporation. Mr. Schreiner.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the court. It's my pleasure to be here today representing Bradley Corporation. I have my colleagues, Mrs. Neubauer and Mr. Helfinger, with me at council table. In these insurance coverage and duty to defend cases, we sometimes find ourselves awash in a welter of words. Words in an insurance policy compared with words in a complaint. And we have to stop and remind ourselves why we care about these words. What's it about? Fortunately, it's about a little bit more than the last case, but at any rate,
is it just the attorney fees, or is it the $1.3 million involved in settlement?
The entire amount is involved.
Is it correct that you're not asking for any money either?
No, Your Honor, it is not at all correct that I'm not asking for any more money. Mr. Croak and I are arguing about which one gets to pose as David and which is Goliath, but I want you to know I've got my slingshot. At its core, this inquiry about what these words are about is it's about the kinds of damages imposed in lawsuits that the insurance company has promised to protect the insured against, promised to pay the damages, and promised to defend the insured in the lawsuit. And because the decision to defend a lawsuit has to be based on the complaint, it comes at the beginning. You can't sort of let it go by default and find out what it was about later. Our law has long held, and this court has long held, that you look to the complaint and the kind of injury that it asserts to decide whether the insurance company has a duty to defend the lawsuit. Sometimes that's easier than in other cases, and in the insurance industry's amicus brief, points out here, if you have a personal injury coverage or a property damage coverage, and the complaint alleges personal injury or property damage, even if it alleges a lot of other things, and even if the property damage or personal injury claim seems baseless or frivolous, the insurance company has to defend. But if you have what the industry calls in its brief a theory-based coverage, like advertising injury, it can be harder to tell, because the definitions of advertising injury are less intuitive. I think that's really why these cases present difficulties. Now, the industry's response to that is to say, well, because of that, these coverages are to be narrowly construed. That's the phrase they use in their brief. And, of course, we submit that's just wrong. That's not the methodology. The methodology has to be the same as it is in any duty to defend case. That is, if there is within the complaint an attempt to recover damages for advertising injury, even if it's a minor claim among many other claims that are not advertising injury claims, even if the advertising injury claim seems baseless or frivolous, the insured is entitled to a defense. And again, it has to do with the fact that you have to make that inquiry right at the beginning. Now, there are claims, certainly, where the insured claim seems like it's the tail wagging the dog, to use another analogy from the last one. Maybe that's the way it seemed to the Court of Appeals in this case. But that doesn't mean there isn't a duty to defend. There's a case a long time ago, 50 years ago, and we've cited in our brief, Lee versus Aetna, where Judge Learned Hand said, you know, whether the insurer ought to defend an action at least until it appears that the claim is not covered isn't free from doubt. But it seems to us that we should resolve the doubt in favor of the insured. And in most cases, the case at bar was won, it will not be difficult for the insurer to compel the injured party, the third party, to disclose whether the injury was within the policy, and if it transpires that it is not, the insurer need not go on any farther. That's the methodology. It's the methodology that applies to an advertising injury case, I submit, as well as any other. Now, it may be at the end of the day, therefore, that the covered claim is dismissed so that the insurance company has no ultimate duty to indemnify. It can reserve against that possibility. But it has a duty until it's clear that there are, in fact, no indemnified claims to defend the action. That's a duty that the insurance company here breached, and that's what I'd like to turn to now. It is very simply why the Lawler complaint asserted advertising injury. And I start at the beginning. I think there's a lot of discussion in the cases. I think the Court of Appeals talked about this idea of cause. The cause is in the original description in the policy of what the insurance applies to. Insurance injury, this is in our case on the page 53 of the appendix in the upper right-hand corner. Advertising injury caused by an offense committed in the course of advertising your goods, products, or services. So the subject matter is that the insured has to be advertising its goods, products, and services. And if in the course of doing that, it commits one of the four advertising injuries that are in the policy, then there's coverage. And that's the cause element. That is, the plaintiff has to allege, I have suffered damages caused by your advertising activity.
Is that the same, counsel? I just want to follow your argument as, you know, the causal connection. I know that your opponent will be discussing that and did so in his brief, but the Court of Appeals seemed to believe that that causal connection was, I'm not sure whether they used the word tenuous, but it was too tenuous to allow recovery. And what you're arguing is no, based on the words of the policy and the complaint, that there was this causal connection, which using a liberal construction, I mean, resolving the doubt in favor of the insured, they should have provided coverage.
Well, what I'm saying is that the policy is the source of the requirement of a causal connection. It's because the policy requires that the advertising injury have caused injury to the third-party plaintiff, Lawler in this case, by an offense of one of the four descriptions. That's the source of the cause requirement. Now, there are cases that I think correctly go off on lack of cause. The Court of Appeals decision in Atlantic Mutual, which the parties have talked about here, the Badger Medical case, was one where at least arguably, I think they got a couple of things wrong in the way they said things there, but at least arguably they were correct. I think they were correct in saying, look, this is a tortious interference with contract claim, all right? Here, the main claim made against somebody who used to work for the plaintiff in that case was that he had a covenant not to compete, which he had breached. And in that case, they also sued the new employer, claiming tortious interference with contract, common enough. And the claim was made by the insurance company, or I'm sorry, by the insured. This is covered by advertising injury because, you know, it turned out later on in the case that one of the things that the employee did was bring along a customer list with him, and a customer list could be used to go out and advertise the product. And the court said the problem with that is, in addition to the fact that it wasn't in the complaint, it only came up in discovery later on, that isn't really what the plaintiff was complaining about. The plaintiff was complaining that the company tortiously interfered with a contract, and it was not a complaint about the insured actually having caused the injury by advertising. And you look at these advertising injury definitions then that start on the bottom of page 54 of the appendix and go over to page 55. And there are four kinds. Judge Posner, in a case that we've cited, sort of characterizes them generally. It says that it's helpful to look at them under this principle of nocitur associis, which we don't say anymore because it's hard to understand, but you know the words by their fellows.
Mr. Schreiner, before you go any further, maybe you could point us to the complaint itself and show us where you are claiming there's allegations of advertising injury.
I would, if I could just set it up one more moment before I get to that. That's exactly where I was headed, Justice Crooks. But what is it that is advertising injury? First of all, as I say, the cause connection is in there. These are what Judge Posner in the Curtis Universal case refers to as claims that what they have in common is that there is offense caused by the conveyance of information, the misuse of information. So it starts out with libel and slander. It includes product disparagement. It includes invasion of privacy. And then it goes to misappropriation of advertising ideas, misappropriation of the style of doing business, and finally, a bunch of other ways in which information are conveyed, trademark being one of them, copyright. Now, trademark gets picked up here in the broadened coverage in the appendix on page 56. But it's the conveyance of information that's the heart of advertising injury. If you are advertising, and again, Atlantic Mutual, I think, correctly said, advertising is you're trying to get people to buy your products, your services, your goods. If you are advertising and you convey information in a wrongful way, you misuse the conveyance of information, then you have an advertising injury claim. And now I'd like to just turn, Justice Crooks, to your question. And this is a long complaint. There are certainly lots of things in this complaint that have nothing to do with advertising injury. There's a claim of breach of fiduciary duty. There is ultimately a patent claim. It was not in the original complaint, but it was in supplement. There was a claim of theft of trade secrets, including manufacturing process trade secrets, but also including business styles. But I want to talk, because I think it's the clearest, is in paragraph 115 and 119 of this complaint. And I'll start on page appendix 48, paragraph 115 of the complaint in the Indianapolis lawsuit. What does it say? It says, Bradley's misappropriation of trade secrets. Now, unfortunately, you know, this is like reading something a lawyer has written. I've got to take you back and remind you that paragraph 72 has a definition of trade secrets. And whenever they use trade secrets in capital letters in this complaint, they mean something more than the kind of trade secrets that we normally think of as trade secret, manufacturing process trade secrets. And I think, frankly, the Court of Appeals got off on this in the wrong tack, because paragraph 72 says that also includes Lawler's annual business and strategic plans, sales reports, and strategies as among the trade secrets that Mr. Klein is supposed to have stolen. Back to 115, Bradley's misappropriation of Lawler's trade secrets, technologies, and designs relating to thermostatic mixing valves, and the use thereof, that is, the dissemination of this information in connection with the accused products, the ones they're saying infringe patents, is a false designation of origin or a false description or representation, and wrongly and falsely designates the origin of Lawler's technology as originating from or being connected with Bradley, and amounts to utilizing a false description or representation in commerce. And then it says we bring this claim under Lanham Act, Section 43A, which is where one finds trademark infringement, where one finds the prohibition in federal law of false information in order to advertise. 119, which is a state law claim under Indiana law and federal common law, the common law unfair competition likewise says, by its aforesaid conduct, Bradley has taken and is misappropriating the valuable goodwill, okay, this is what we're saying, this is our loss attributable to this, so carefully and diligently created. Bradley's conduct is likely to cause confusion or mistake or to deceive and is likely to mislead the public. Now that is, if that doesn't suggest that Bradley is conveying to the consuming public, it says, there is consumer confusion about the source of goods. What the complaint is, you've stolen our technology, and therefore the consuming public, whoever it is who buys these plumbing supplies, thinks that our goods have their source in Bradley. You have destroyed our goodwill. That's the complaint. There are specific references, although it seems to me these are plenty, in paragraphs 63 and 72 of the complaint to what can only be called advertising activity. Paragraph 63 said that Bradley displayed these systems incorporating the accused products at a trade show. And paragraph 72 says that, I'm sorry, getting my numbers wrong here. Paragraph 55 says that the valve attached as Exhibit D are copies of selected Bradley materials promoting as well as installation and maintenance instructions for these accused products.
Counsel, it is, just so that I'm following, it is the language from Count 8, your common law tort of unfair competition,
right.
That you are asserting the basis of this destroying our goodwill and the advertising language necessary to come under the policy provisions.
To come under the policy 7 and 8, Justice Bradley.
Seven is the trade secret.
Well, seven is also false designation of origin, false descriptions or representations, wrongfully, falsely designating the origin, false description or representation in commerce. All of those are claims that Bradley is conveying information about its product that is false, with the loss to the plaintiff asserted of goodwill, lost profits, the necessity of going out and correcting the false impression left in the marketplace by Bradley to the effect that this stuff, which Lawler says is ours, is Bradley's.
The Lanham Act referred to in Count 7 is the trade secret?
No, it's trademark. And it is broader than that, Your Honor. I mean, it talks about it is the way that federal law protects any misrepresentation, any misstatement of fact in an advertising context by prescribing it. Now,
and then it is in Count 8, your common law tort of unfair competition, which really gets to the language that you were.
Count 8 is more explicit. I think Count 7 is explicit, too. And there is one more, and this is the one that the circuit court relied on. And he said he didn't need to go any farther, Judge Cooper. And that's in paragraph 72. And in paragraph 72, the part I referred to a moment ago where they define what they mean by trade secrets in the complaint, they include Lawler's annual business and strategic plans, sales reports, and strategies, which, in our view, are advertising ideas or style of doing business under that third, if that's the number of it, type of advertising injury. And then, in paragraph 85, the complaint says that Bradley has used them in a way so as to cause damage to Lawler. And in paragraph 92, it says that's caused the loss of business opportunities, potential loss of goodwill. Judge Cooper said, and I think he's correct, look, trade secrets include what I think are advertising ideas and style of doing business. They include the marketing plans, the sales strategies that the client allegedly took with him to Bradley. You've misappropriated them. You've stolen them. There's been a lot of ink spilled about what misappropriation means. I think it means stealing. You've stolen them, and you've used them in a way that has harmed us. You've used them. How do you use advertising ideas? You convey to others that this is ours when, in fact, it is supposed to be Lawler's. And that's the heart of this. I don't say it isn't a difficult case. It is a difficult case. But it seems to me that, properly understood, this really does say you stole information from us and that you conveyed it to people in a way, in an advertising sort of way, in order to further the sale of your goods, products, and businesses. Now, the Court of Appeals goes through and says, well, you know, you're claiming under trademark coverage, which is one of those, and the word trademark or trade dress is never in the complaint. But, you know, it cannot be the case, and again, the Curtis Universal case talks about this, labels can't be the answer. what you call it can't be enough. You aren't even required under either federal pleading, which applied to this case because it was in a federal court in Indianapolis, or even under our state pleading, to say what the basis of your claim is. The complaint here is that information was conveyed to a consuming public who were confused by the conveyance of that information into thinking that this stuff that should have been attributed to Lawler was Bradley's. That they're accusing us of a knockoff. They're accusing us very much as what Judge Posner talked about in the Universal case, which actually came from Wisconsin, and where Judge Posner predicted what this court would do about advertising injury law. He said about the allegations there, which were that Orange Cross was trying to get people to call the 911 number in Sheboygan and get the Curtis ambulance, people who were looking for the Curtis ambulance to call Orange Cross. He said in upholding advertising injury coverage here under a different form of policy, this was very close to an attempt to pass Orange Cross off as Curtis, the core trademark infringement. That's what this complaint is about. That's what this Lawler complaint is about. You, Bradley, are trying to pass yourself off as Lawler. It's a core trademark complaint. Now, at the time Curtis Universal was decided, there was not a trademark coverage in advertising injury policies. There is now. We have, for the last two policy years at least, trademark coverage included just in so many words as an advertising injury because, of course, it does fit in like those other things. It's a way in which information is misused to the detriment of a plaintiff and the sort of thing for which one wants to get insurance if one is running a business and running advertising.
Well, go ahead.
Counsel, you've given us four or five paragraphs from the complaint that you allege constitute advertising injury. I take it more specifically you're saying that those paragraphs come under subsection C.
C or D.
5.
C or D.
C or D.
Or D. D is trademark. And okay, D is trademark is the aspect. And that's where I have to make sure that I don't lose you on this, because D in the...
D talks about copyright, title, or slogan.
Right. I have to take you to the next page, because on Appendix 56, up in the upper right-hand corner, there's a D that includes trademark. The last 2 years, which are the relevant years in this case, include a coverage for trademark explicitly.
All we have to do is add the word trademark in D on
right.
page 55, and that
right.
brings it up to date.
All right. Although that's right, Your Honor. Although it is our view that trademark coverage was also afforded in effect by the misappropriation of advertising ideas and style of doing business, given the allegations in this complaint, that we wouldn't need the trademark coverage. But the trademark coverage, it seems to me, for the reasons that Judge Posner says, passing yourself off as someone else, passing your products off as somebody else's products, with the alleged harm caused by that, there's the causal connection.
Could you enlighten me as to what is involved in the use of the word trademark and what, if anything, any relationship that has to patent infringement?
The patent infringement, of course, which is the chief or one of the chief allegations in this complaint, says, I, plaintiff, have a monopoly of the right to use this product because I invented it and I've disclosed to the public how I did it, and as a reward for that, I have a monopoly, and I can exclude you from selling the product at all. That's one of the claims they make here. They also say, however, and this is a way in which trademark is different, that, they say there is another claim, and that is that even if that weren't subject to a patent, you may not, in this case, appropriate something distinctive about my product, referred to sometimes as trade dress, something that identifies it as my product. You may not take that and claim it as yours. And that, again, that is exactly what we're being accused of here. That's what trademark coverage is about. You know, there are registered trademarks, and one of the cases is about, you know, a PGA golf course that had the letters PGA, and then they lost their license, and did they have to take the PGA down off this golf course? And the Fifth Circuit said yes. But 43A is really about non-registered trademarks, something distinctive that marks out your product as being yours.
And what paragraphs in the complaint specifically allege a trademark violation?
115 and 116.
115.
But they don't.
Oh, and 116 or 119?
115 and 116. 115 is the one I read to you. 116 says this is brought under the Lanham Act. I think 119 goes to trademark as well. But the point of it, Your Honor, is any you don't have to use labels. You don't have to use the words. You don't have to say trademark. But if your complaint is you've appropriated something that identifies this product in the public's mind with me, plaintiff, you've stolen that, and now you're out there and people see your product and they assume that mine must be a knockoff of yours, or you've caused me to lose profits, that you've somehow engaged in a trademark infringement. And the core of trademark infringement is passing off the defendant's products as the plaintiff's.
What's so distinctive about this product? I think one of the briefs mentions, or one of the cases, the blue collar on a particular...
Yeah, the blue Badger Meter collar.
Right. Okay. So there it's distinctive. You could have another similar product, but no blue collar.
I think, with respect, the blue collar is a red herring. The point about it is this. We don't know. The complaint says that they've passed it off as theirs. Now, there's a lot of ink spilled about whether or not this is a distinctive feature and a non-functional feature. The complaint says that they've passed off, that we've passed off our product as theirs. What the insurance company is suggesting is, well, if the aspect of the product that we're passing off is functional, it's not subject to trademark protection. I mean, you cannot, you know, I think it's Judge Easterbrook's case where he says you can't get a trademark in a football and not allow anybody to use a football shaped like a football. If it's functional, it's not subject to trademark. You can put your initials on it. My point is that as the complaint is drafted, we don't know how the plaintiff intended to prove that this was distinctive. All they're saying is you're trying to pass off your product as ours. That's a subject of defense. It may be non-functionality would have been a defense. It may be that if the insurance company had come in and defended this case, they could have gotten the trademark claim thrown out. But they didn't.
Right. That's a question of proof, not
That's
pleading.
A question of proof.
And this is a duty to defend.
And there's a little twist, too, because after this case, the trademark statute was amended. And now the plaintiff has to allege non-functionality in the complaint. But at the time, that was not the case. It's a question of defense. And it's a defense we're entitled to. If the complaint, and this is another point, if the complaint against the insured doesn't state a claim, you're still entitled to have the insurance company come in and get it thrown out, even if it's frivolous, even if it's baseless. You don't leave the insured to defend himself and hope that he's right. And that's as long ago as the Grebe case. Justice Hallows pointed that out in the case about the Mitchell Park domes. Even if the case is frivolous, even if the case is baseless, if they try to assert a claim that is covered under the coverage, the insurance company has to come in and defend.
So as I read some of these cases, they take a narrow view of what is an advertising injury, because I think the cases think that if you broaden the concept of advertising injury, you're going to cover everything.
Well, that's always the argument. You know, it's the parade of horribles, the old law school trick. And I think that's really what's the matter with the Advance Watch case out of the Sixth Circuit. There, the product was a fat pen, supposedly a distinctive style. And the Sixth Circuit said, well, that can't be subject to trademark protection because that's just a product. But, of course, it is subject to trademark protection. If I have a distinctive styled pen that's identified with me and you knock it off, you know, you try to pass off your pen as being mine or make people think that my pen is manufactured by you, that's a violation of trademark.
Well, suppose just sell this product. They don't go to a trade show, put it in stores, and it's on the shelf, and they sell it. Under circumstances similar to this. Is that going to be an advertising injury?
Not if the allegation is not in the complaint that we tried to confuse the public by how we did it, by the way we held it out. We're helped by the fact that there is an ad referred to, by the fact that there was a trade show. But it seems to me, even beyond that, 115 and 119 say that we're out holding this out to the public and confusing the public. It is implicit in there that we're advertising.
So holding out to the public your product with your label on it is, you think, sufficient to bring it within this insurance policy, even though my concept of advertising doesn't quite fit that?
Well, certainly if the plaintiff says that you're confusing the consumers, it seems to me implicit in that is that you are advertising in some fashion. They could have left those allegations out of this complaint. This could have been a complaint that you just infringed our patents, that Mr. Klein didn't behave himself properly, and that you stole our technology manufacturing trade secrets, and it would not be covered by advertising injury.
What exactly is the style of business, I'm referring to the insurance contract, that you say has been misappropriated?
We think it is exactly what they're talking about in 115. That is the way our product looks, is our style of doing business. Judge Cooper, in his memorandum decision, cited to a couple of cases that say that that's what style of doing business is.
And the infringement here of trademark is what?
It is the allegation of infringement of trademark is that Bradley held out to the consuming public this product, this design, as being its own, when in fact it was Lawler's. And so we're passing off our product, our thermostatic mixing valve devices, as being our own, when in fact they belong to the plaintiff.
And when they have to, your view is that Fireman's has to defend all of these allegations here?
That's the law, Judge, and that is very clear. I'm sorry, Chief Justice, I forgot where I was. And you've got to come in and defend all of them, and as I said before, you can get some of them knocked out if they don't state claims, but that's well understood. Any one claim that's covered entitles you to a defense of the whole thing. You may not have to pay the damages at the end if the jury comes back and assesses the damages on patent infringement and finds none for the trademark infringement, then the insurance company does not need to pay.
Well, what if they get it knocked out early in the lawsuit? Can they then withdraw their defense?
Yes, Your Honor, they can. They can say the only covered defense in here is the one that the court just threw out for failure to state a claim. Now, we will defend you if that goes up on appeal later on, but for now, giving you enough advance notice, because, of course, they've hired a lawyer who owes the client the duty of not leaving them high and dry, they can withdraw. And I think that's implicit in the fact that once the case no longer includes, that's implicit in the Lee case, once the case no longer includes an insured claim, the insurance company owes no duty to defend.
Justice Bradley has a question.
Counsel, is your definition of advertising conveyance of any information about your product?
That is conveyed within it. Advertising is defined. The Atlantic Mutual case pulls some definition out of another case that ultimately came from the dictionary. And it's the way you promote your product, the way you try to sell it, the way you hold it out to the public. And this way that they've alleged here is one of those ways.
So it's not so, your definition of advertising isn't so broad as I stated, conveyance of any information about your product.
No, it's conveyance of information about your product intended to sell it, intended to promote it, as I think is the allegation with respect to the ads. You're trying to sell your product. That's what people buy coverage. That's why you get advertising injury coverage.
And that included the packaging, I.e.
That includes the packaging. And that's where this phrase trade dress, I mean, it's, trade dress is a trademark. I mean, it is, if there's something distinctive about your product, people look at it and say, you know, that's a Bradley thermostatic mixing valve device. And when in fact they should be thinking it's a Lawler thermostatic valve device, that's a trademark claim. It's a trade dress claim.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Croak, representing Fireman's Fund Insurance Company of Wisconsin.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. If it please the court, also with me is Mr. Todd Rowe, who helped, I guess I'd call him the brains of the outfit, helped did the briefing and knows a lot about it. And he wishes he were up here and having the opportunity to argue today, but I usurped it because of age. So I hope I'm not sorry I did that.
We'll see.
I understand, Chief Justice. This is a pleadings case. Make no mistake about it. And the rule that applies is the rule that this court set forth in the Shorewood case, which was premised upon the Sola Basic case, which was premised upon the Grebe case. So we're now back in 1967, which was even before I started practicing law. Not by much, but close. And it is basically, the rule is, look at the words of the complaint. Let's not look what might have been pled. Let's look at what was pled. And that's important in here. Now, Bradley's brief calls this 26-page, two documents, 128-paragraph pleading inartful. It was inartfully pled. I find that a little difficult to believe. They did a pretty good job of pleading, these lawyers. And not, there are certain things that are not contained in the complaint. And, of course, as said by the Court of Appeals, and it's been repeated by our brief, but I'm going to say it again, never once do you see in 128 paragraphs trademark or trade dress. It's not in there.
What is the Lanham Act claim, then, if not a trademark?
The Lanham Act, well, they don't describe it very well, to be very honest with you.
Oh,
but
it was inartful.
Pardon?
So it was inartful.
Well, let's go to paragraph 115, because that's the basis of it. And it is a pleading that you misappropriated our trade secrets, technologies, and designs, and use them in connection with their products, and that wrongfully and falsely designated the origin of Lawler's thermostatic mixing valves. Now, the Court of Appeals, they relied on the treatise by McCarthy, and McCarthy pointed out that misappropriation and unfair competition can mean a lot of things. In fact, I think what he says is it can mean basically what any court ultimately decides it means. And so it covers a wealth of things.
Except according to the language of this paragraph of the complaint, this is a false designation of origin type of Lanham Act.
Absolutely.
And how is it that that's not a trademark claim?
How is it not a trademark? Well, they don't say, where. First you have to ask yourself, where in the complaint is there anything about trademark? Does it say anything about trademark? Trademark involves some distinctive, non-functional aspect of this valve. It's just a valve.
Let me ask it differently then.
Okay.
Isn't this type of Lanham Act claim by definition a trademark claim?
No, that's the point. It is not. It could be lots of different things, and they tell you what it is. You took our trade secrets, our technologies. Our technologies are the patents.
Right.
You used our patents. You took our trade secrets. They define trade secrets, and counsel has referred to what they are. In, I think it was paragraph, I forget the exact paragraph, maybe 72 or something like that. And if you look at back at that paragraph, might as well do that as long as we're here, you took highly confidential and proprietary information, which included our business and strategic plans, our sales reports, strategies, pricing margin and profitability information, material pricing and distribution costs, new product development, technology, personnel information. None of those things have anything to do with a trade dress, or even advertising. All of those items are how they go about competing in the market. That's their business information as to how they go competing. When you're talking about trade dress or trade mark, what you're talking about is some unique, non-functional, decorative, ornamental, frivolous, some kind of thing about the object. And this complaint never says that this valve, like in the Badger Meter versus Grinnell case, there we had the Badger Brew. Excuse me. I'm in beer here. Badger Blue. And the dial, and they had the raised things. All those distinctive features dealing with trademark. None of these items deal with that or advertising.
Well, what is the gravamen of count 7, then, as we say in the criminal law? What's the gravamen of that offense, then, if not you stole our designs, our ideas, our method of doing business, and attempted to pass it off as your own?
No, it doesn't say method of doing business at all.
Isn't that what 72 says?
No, I don't think so. I didn't see method of doing business in paragraph 72. Maybe I missed it.
Isn't that what annual business and strategic plan, sales reports and strategies?
No, it's not. That's not their method of doing business. That's the information they use in deciding how to market their how they're going to go about competing in the market with this valve. I think it's a stretch to say that that is their style of doing business, and that's the implication I'm getting from you, is that what you're saying is that this is the same as style of doing business under sub C, and I don't think it is.
What would technology be then?
Technology is using your patents. See, that's the problem here, is what they did was, allegedly, they took along, when Mr. Klein left, he took along all this patented materials, put it all together, and now they're selling it.
Right.
And the confusion is, as they plead in here, the confusion is people are going to look at this and they're going to see it and think it's Bradley's, as opposed to or not in terms of anything about the ornamental design or anything, because it functions, because of the function of it, they'll think it's Bradley's instead of Lawler's.
Okay, well then go back to the original question that I guess I didn't let you answer. What is the heart of the Lanham Act claim?
The heart of the Lanham Act claim, as I see it, is you cause confusion by having out there a patented item that is our patents, and people are going to be confused, and they are going to think that this item here really is a Bradley thing, when it really isn't. It's a Lanham technology. And so the confusion is they're going to go buy this because they think this works. It has the ability to work like the Lanham or the
Lawler,
excuse me, thank you, Your Honor, the Lawler valve. And so that they think that they're getting something that works like the Lawler valve, and it doesn't, and they're going to buy the wrong valve.
How is that passing off not an advertising injury?
An advertising injury is something that you do with your ads. You promote it having how can I say it? Advertising. We all see it. You see it on television. You see it in the newspapers.
Well, this isn't the type of product that would be advertised on television, though.
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly,
so we don't confine ourselves to those sort of notions of advertising.
No, I appreciate that. And I'm not sure how you would have. I know that there's an allegation that they put it in a brochure.
A trade show.
They went to a trade show with it, yes.
The product's mocked up.
And there it is, and there's a product. And there's
advertising it. As ours when it's really yours.
Well, then not as ours as it's real. Well, I guess I'll buy that. I'll go along with you on that. Okay. Now, the loss has to be in connection with that advertising. Okay. And that's not pled in here. They don't say that the loss is we have a loss because I think the language is that the injury must be committed in the course of advertising the goods. Okay, there's no allegation in here that they were injured because of the advertising. The claim, the loss in what the Court of Appeals said is the loss is because you took the stuff, you took the patents, you used those patents. That's where the injury occurred, not because you sold it.
Well, you tried to pass it off, so that's the whole cost of count 7.
Yep. If you say that just because you sell it, you're advertising, then every time anybody sells something, they're advertising. That's not true. That's not advertising. The case, all these cases say that that's not true. simply selling the product. You need more than that.
But we do have more than that in this complaint, don't
we? I don't think you do. What more do you have? Nobody else seems, I know Bradley seems to think so. The Court of Appeals didn't seem to think so. And we don't think so. There's nothing in here that says your advertising is the source of the problem. The source of the problem is you stole our technologies.
Is it your position that the complaint, in order to plead an advertising injury, had to plead specific damages flowing from that trade show, for example?
Sure. The policy says there's elements to it. Okay? And I seem to have lost a piece of paper here that had the test. Okay? There are four elements. You have to misappropriate the advertising idea, okay, or the style of doing business. All right? Now, there's no allegation in this complaint that Bradley, you took Lawler's advertising idea and used it. There's just no allegation of that. Okay? Or you took our style of doing business. And there's no allegation that they took their style of doing business. I guess our debate was whether paragraph 72 says that or not. I don't think it says that. It says that you took all kinds of information that you can use to compete in the market. That's not a style of doing business. Secondly, then, the next thing that you have to have is that it has to be committed in the course of advertising, not just that you sold the product. The injury, and you have to have a causal connection between the misappropriation committed in the course of advertising and an injury. And you have an injury. And I'll even give you the misappropriation. But you've got to have the committed in the course of advertising and then a causal connection between the advertising and the injury. And those allegations are missing from this complaint.
But they might be missing, but isn't it implicit? I mean, without advertising, nobody knows that you've got it. It's sort of like a tree falling in the forest. When no one's around to hear it. If they've got the product, but nobody knows that they've got the product, there's going to be no injury. So it somehow word has to get out to the public by way of advertising, some form of advertising, that they've got the product.
So
isn't there always a causal connection?
Well, there's not always a causal
between
connection.
Between the advertising and the injury. There has to be where the Court of Appeals gave you the victory was they said there was no causal connection between the advertising and the injury.
Right.
But isn't there always got to be? Because without advertising, who knows that Bradley's got the product?
Well, there can't always be a causal connection. There's plenty of case law where they held there is no causal connection. If there's a disconnect, because you advertise the product doesn't mean that there necessarily is a causal connection between the advertising and the loss. Otherwise, what you're suggesting is that, assuming they go on and they try this case, that the court is going to rule as a matter of law on cause.
But if Bradley,
it's never an issue of fact.
If Bradley manufactured this product but never let anybody know that they had it, there would be no injury.
No, they're saying that you've
right?
I mean, they sold it. You don't necessarily have to advertise it. You can take it out, and for instance, I bring along this object, and I bring it to you, and I say I want to sell it to you. Am I advertising? The answer is no. The cases that we've cited in the brief say no. That's not true.
Well, was there any packaging of this article?
There's no allegation that there is. Nothing unusual about the packaging. That's part of the whole problem. All of these things are missing, and they're not alleged. And see, and I think that part of the problem here is we go back to the rule of Shorewood, okay, in interpreting this complaint. And I think what Bradley is asking this court to do is to fill in the gaps.
What about paragraph 55, which counsel referred to? Attached is Exhibit D. I don't know if they're attached here. I don't remember them, but we can find them. Are copies of selected Bradley materials promoting, as well as installation and maintenance instructions for these accused products?
Yes, and what that was, you do not have it. It was not made a part of the record. I'm sorry?
It's not in the record?
It is not.
It's not attached to the complaint?
It was, but that is As far as I recall, back when I got the complaint, Your Honor, I didn't get a copy of that brochure. So it might have been attached to the underlying complaint, but when that complaint was attached to the complaint in this case, or I'm sorry, the answer in this case,
right,
we didn't have it.
Because this is a complaint in the federal court.
That's,
okay.
Yeah, okay.
But that's a public record now, I assume.
It is, I'm sure, Judge, but it's not in your record is the point. But it was a brochure.
What about the trade show? Trade shows, it seems to me, has got everything to do with advertising your product, whether it's a Canadian fishing trip or a consumer electronics show in Las Vegas. It's designed to advertise your product to the public.
I understand, Your Honor. I don't disagree. But now you have to have a causal connection between that advertising and the loss, the injury. That's what the policy says.
Mr. Croak, you started to talk a little bit about Shorewood.
Yes,
sir. And the duty to defend. And if Justice Babich is finished, I'd like to explore that a little bit. My understanding of Shorewood and of Western States and the other cases that look at the duty to defend is that basically we're told that that duty to defend should be liberally construed. As I listen to the arguments you've been making, it strikes me that what you're talking about is a very restrictive approach to the duty to defend. Do you want to explain your position?
Thank you, Your Honor. If gave the impression that it's restrictive, I apologize. I don't think so. I have no problems with the rule in Shorewood.
Well, don't we look at inferences as well? You keep talking about there's no causal connection spelled out. Don't we look at inferences that can be drawn from the four corners of the complaint?
Well, what you have to do, Your Honor, let me yes. In a direct answer, the answer is fair inferences, though, reasonable inferences. It's not anything that you can imagine. I mean, if the rule is you can imagine it, tell me to sit down because I'm done, because I'm sure anybody can imagine anything they want to.
I'm not advocating that rule.
Okay, thank you.
Fair to infer that as part of the proofs in the underlying federal action, there would be some information of sales that would be then causally linked to the advertising activity that is alleged, the promotional brochures and the trade show?
I'm not sure I totally understand the question, but might there be evidence of sales? Yes, there might be.
There's a damages claim.
Yeah, there's clearly a damages claim.
It's an injunction.
Right, I understand that.
And so we can infer that as part of the proof of the damages claim, there would be proof of Lanham Act damages.
Due to the confusion
sales
in the market.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the advertising or necessarily have anything to do with trademark or trade dress. You still have to have the causal connection. And we cited the Frog Switch case, for instance. And Frog Switch said, in that case, they found that there's an advertising and they allege a loss, but there's no connection and therefore there's no coverage and no duty under the policy. And that's the point, is how far are you going to go in adding the allegations here that aren't here? They're missing. Even they say they're missing. They don't agree that they're there. You look at their arguments and they say, well, it's plausible that they will perhaps make this claim. And it's your duty under the Shorewood case, if it's not impossible to make that claim, then it's in. See, and this gets back to Justice Crook's case, or question to me, is I think that Bradley is twisting the rule. The rule isn't if it's impossible. The rule is look at the allegations, and if the allegations are there and you can draw a fair or reasonable inference, that's fine. But you can't substitute in words that aren't there. I think in the amicus brief, they cited to the Midway Motor Lodge case where the Court of Appeals rejected the argument that the plaintiffs or an insured can't rely on the concept of notice pleading to supply missing or forgotten elements needed to trigger insurance coverage. What's being the argument that was being made Bradley's brief is that the courts shouldn't punish the insured because the pleader didn't do a good job of pleading. There's no punishment involved. The sole issue is whether or not the pleading that the insurance company gets fairly sets forth a claim that's covered under the policy. If it's not, it's not. If they do their discovery and they ultimately have that kind of a claim, they can subsequently tender it to the insurance company. And the point came up before is that these cases point out is every time you have a product, there's going to be some form of advertising. You're always going to have a form of advertising. Otherwise, people are in business. I think Justice Babish pointed out to me, you're selling a product, you're going to advertise it. Well, then you might as well say, if the word advertising appears in the complaint, bang, we're in. And that's not true.
Counsel, I'd like to take a look again at the policy, and I'm referring to Appendix 53, page in the red brief, where
just grab it. Excuse me. I'm with you, Your Honor.
Good. Very top of the right column where it says, insurance applies to number two. Advertising injury caused by an offense committed in the course of advertising your goods, products, or services. Now, I want to define those words, and I assume that you're going to be able to help me look to the policy to define those words. And so I read sub 2 as saying, an offense committed in the course of advertising that causes advertising injury. And I've turned it around a bit. Offense is what causes injury. Offense causes injury. So what, first of all, the type of offense that might be covered, I think, is found in the bottom of Appendix 54, in the definitions, and continues on to page 55, the top left column. And that defines offense. And it includes C, misappropriation of advertising ideas, or D, infringement of copyright. So we know what the offense is. It's misappropriating. It might be stealing something. It's infringing. So we know what the offense is.
Right.
So, and I think I know what advertising injury is. Is that defined here also?
No, Your Honor.
In this sense, perhaps.
It is, Your Honor.
It's defined at the bottom of page 53, advertising injury arising out of.
Right.
So it at least narrows the definition of
right.
advertising injury. So that leaves me with the question, offense committed in the course of advertising. What is advertising? Where is that defined?
Advertising is defined by the case law, Your Honor.
So we don't find the definition of advertising here.
No, what you can find it is in Atlantic Mutual case, which is in 191 Wisconsin 2nd.
That's a court of appeals case.
It is, Your Honor.
So in large part, since everything else is defined in the contract itself,
right.
The thing that we're grappling about is how do you define advertising since it's not defined in the contract?
Well, there's more to it than that, but maybe that is a part of what we're talking about. But advertising is promoting your product. I think we all can agree with that. What we're grappling here with is, at least as far as I'm concerned, what we're grappling about is whether there are allegations in the complaint that say that the offense, i.e. the injury, was caused in
I know, and that's why I go to, you know, the definitions, because it seems to me we have to define these terms before we then can apply what they mean to see if it's found in the complaint.
Yes, absolutely. I 100% agree with that. And if they're not defined in the policy, then you have to look to the case law. And I think we do have case law that's pretty universally accepted as to what advertising is and what advertising injury. In fact, courts throughout the United States have been citing Atlantic Mutual. They all seem to agree that Atlantic Mutual fairly defines what advertising is, what advertising idea is, what style of doing business is. It's a well-recognized case throughout the United States as to those definitions.
I have a clarification question.
Sure.
This is a duty to defend case.
It is.
There's an indemnification award in this judgment, as I read it. Is that correct?
Yes, there is.
How did that happen?
Well, under the rules of state of Wisconsin, if the insurance company doesn't intervene and ask for a stay and they just deny coverage and leave the insured on their own, then part of the penalty is, and they go ahead and settle it, part of the penalty is you're stuck with the indemnification if you ultimately turn out to be wrong.
So we don't have an issue on that?
No, we don't have an issue on that.
We have an issue about the attorney fees.
We do have an issue about that. I hate to agree with Mr. Schreiner on anything, but I will agree with on that one aspect that issue is not in here. We also have the issue, of course, of late notice. And this is a little bit more of an indicia. This complaint wasn't tendered for 16 months after the lawsuit was started. In fact, it wasn't tendered until after the amended complaint was served. Did anybody else read this as including advertising loss for 16 months? Apparently not. The insurance company wasn't the only one who didn't read this complaint as including an advertising injury loss.
What was the prejudice?
The prejudice is that it was tendered after a year, and there's a presumption of prejudice. And it is our position that Bradley did not demonstrate that there was no prejudice, and that's the law, and I don't think there's any dispute on that either, on the law, that there's a presumption.
You participated in the settlement negotiations, though, right?
No, we were invited to go along, but they did not participate. The case was long, had been handled for, our position is, how would we be in a position at that stage of the proceedings? It's a case is an enormous discovery, and you really have to, if you're going to take on a case of this magnitude, you don't jump into it, after 14, 15, 16 months, and then all of a sudden know enough to be involved in making decisions as to how much money is.
I just want to ask one question, and I know this is not a cited case, but this court has made it. This is a case called Newhouse versus Citizens. It was an insurance case, and it was about coverage and duty to defend. And in there, basically, the case basically stood for the fact that the duty to defend requires a quote, broad interpretation of the policy favoring coverage. Now, that's another issue, but here I'm listening to my colleagues as we go through the words of the policy itself and then, of course, the words of the actual complaint. And when I first looked at this, I said, well, okay, this is the way you look at. Yes, there is coverage, and then I went back and I, as I usually do, I read the briefs and I said, no, there isn't coverage, and you know, back and forth. But basically, the premise is that there is, it's a liberal construction of coverage.
A liberal construction of the policy.
Of the policy, yes.
But that doesn't mean that you should substitute words into the complaint that aren't there, is my point. And that's where the dispute is, not what's in the policy, it's what's in the complaint.
You have to have, and you're saying the actual words are not there.
Well, you have to have some words to suggest it. And it gets back, to, I think, to the I don't know if you remember this was, probably wasn't the first question, but Justice Badlish mentioned the word, well, it's implicit in there. And I don't think it is implicit in there. I think somebody's got to say it. Now, some of you are of my generation back when we all had to plead all these ultimate facts, and we got into notice pleading.
Before your generation.
Well, I think I'm almost with all of the oldest members here. The point of it is that you don't, I agree, you don't have to do all that anymore. But you have to say something that suggests, and what they say is that if you liberally construe this complaint, it suggests these things. And I'm saying is that you can't insert words. I think one of the citations here I thought was a pretty good, it was a, and I don't remember the case, but it was out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And it said, we don't torture the words until they confess ambiguity, so that we can then jump in and say, okay, I found it. I guess that was my point when I said, yes, you can infer anything you want to. Tell me to sit down if that's the rule. And I understand it. And that's what I'm trying to say is what they are doing is they're torturing the words of the complaint to get in what's not there. If these pleaders, these lawyers, wanted to say it, they very easily could have said it. They had 128 paragraphs to get it in, and they didn't say it. And the reason they didn't say it, as far as our position is concerned, and I think it's fairly a fair interpretation, is they didn't say it because they didn't want to make the claim. And basically, I think what's happening here is it reminds me a little bit of when I had my little, when my kids were little kids, and they had these little things, and they had to put the triangle and the triangle and the square and the square and the round, and they're trying to put a square peg in a round hole, and it's not here, and that's why they're interpreting these words to say something that isn't there, and they're asking you to put in words. Implicit, add it in. In fact, I think Mr. Schreiner said it's implicit. It doesn't say anything about implicit in here. So,
could I ask you about some of the allegations in paragraph 119 of the complaint?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a reference to the public being misled, confusion, mistake. Are those advertising injuries?
No, they're just misled by seeing the item, as far as I can tell. That doesn't mean that they're misled by the advertising. They're misled because they're seeing that this thing is being, it looks like the Lawler valve, and they think it's the Lawler thermal mixing valve as opposed to something different. So I don't think that simply because the public is misled, because when they go back and you put it in terms of 15, they talk about the fact that it's the technologies that are involved. And that's the point. Now we're back at patent law. See, the whole idea of this whole thing, and I know my red light's on and I apologize, but the whole idea of this thing is that we want to encourage competition. We want to encourage copying. We think this in the United States, we think this is good. What we do is we protect inventors for 17 years under patent law. You come up with an invention, that's great, and we'll give you certain protections. But after 17 years, it's good that we're going to have competition. So during that 17 years, you get the benefit of your invention. You can sell it, and other people can follow it. And what we're trying to protect in trade dress and trademark is that you came up with something unique. The tacos case. You have a taco hat, and you can't, other people can't use that because they'll start thinking, oh, this is, belongs to that outfit. And so we have developed trade dress protection. We have these protections. What this policy is trying to do is to give you certain insurance coverage if that has something to do with your advertising. And that's what's not in the complaint. Nothing says that there's anything that's connected, the loss or the injury is connected to the advertising. And that's what the Court of Appeals realized, is that there was a disconnect. And I forget which case specifically said it, but those are the words of one of these cases. There's got to be a connection between the advertising and the injury. It's got to be caused in the course of advertising. Those words are not in the complaint, nothing even remotely close to that in the complaint.
Counsel, should you not prevail, This has to go back for a determination of attorney fees?
Yes, Your Honor. And also, I think on the issue, I don't know whether you're going to address the issue of the late notice.
That was my next question.
Okay. Because the Court of Appeals didn't
I know.
Deal.
But that's because they held for you, so they didn't have to do the others. But should you not prevail, you think this has to go back on the issue of late notice?
I think under the rules that it would be appropriate, unless this Court feels that it can rule as a matter of law, but I guess I believe that it should be sent back for them to make a determination on the issue of the late notice as well.
As I've read your brief and listened to your argument, you really view this complaint as just an infringement on patents, don't you?
No. Unfair competition as well.
Unfair competition.
You competed unfairly.
Pardon me? And how do they compete unfairly?
They got all of their inside confidential information, so they knew how to go out in the market and compete. They had inside information. I think that's back to right, and I think that's back to paragraph 72 that Justice Sykes and I discussed at some length.
I don't see any further questions, so counsel, thank you for your argument, and we have 5 minutes of rebuttal by Mr. Schreiner.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you on behalf of my client.
Thank you, Chief Justice, for giving me 5 minutes. I ran at least as long over as Mr. Crook did, and I appreciate it. Let me just briefly talk about late notice and prejudice. You know, the statute's clear. If you get in within a year, it's the insurance company's burden. If you get in after a year, it's the insured's burden. This was 15 months. The insured met its burden. It took the deposition of the claims manager. He said, this wasn't covered. You couldn't have told me more that would have made me cover this claim. I didn't think it came within. There wasn't anything more to do. It seems to me we have sustained our burden of overcoming the presumption. I think you can handle that yourself. There's nothing more to be done about that. That was submitted on summary judgment to Judge Cooper. He resolved it. I think you can resolve it. You could send it to the Court of Appeals to resolve it. They've got enough to do, and you've got the case. Justice Prosser, you ask a question about what's the meaning of this stuff in 119 about causing confusion, likely to mislead the public. And it seems to me, you know, you ask, is that the advertising injury? I think in Justice Bradley's terms, that's the offense. That's the violation. That's one of those things mentioned in D. The injury is harm to our goodwill, lost sales, lost profits that they ask for in an undifferentiated way at the end of the complaint attributable to all of the conduct that they're complaining about. I don't think there's, again, remember, plaintiffs who are suing people who happen to be insured with advertising injury coverage don't usually sit down and say, how do I draft this so that he does or doesn't have coverage? And that's the problem. That's why we get into the Sherwood rule. That's why we get into the rule that says that an insurer's duty to defend the insured in a third-party suit is predicated on allegations in a complaint which, if proven, would give rise to the possibility of recovery under the terms and conditions of the insurance policy. That was present here. Justice Sykes, you asked about what are they going to do with these ads. There's this California case, Elcom, where we've cited. You have to assume if they attach ads to the complaint, they might be thinking about using them as proof at the trial of advertising. Now, and Chief Justice, if I can, the ads were attached to the federal court complaint when the declaratory judgment complaint was filed here, whether it was in the complaint or the answer, that exhibit was not attached. We can provide it to the court if you want to. It's exactly what the paragraph of the complaint says it does. It shows a picture of the product, and it's a description of the product. We can give that to you if you want it. It doesn't add anything beyond what the complaint itself characterizes it as being. This is a Lanham Act claim. The Lanham Act prescribes the use of any word, term, name, symbol, or device, or any false designation of origin, false or misleading description of fact, or false or misleading representation of fact, which is likely to cause confusion or to cause mistake or to deceive as to the affiliation, connection, or association of such person with another person, or as to the origin, sponsorship, or approval of his or her goods, services, or commercial activities by another person. That claim is the classic description of how you get remedy for trademark infringement in federal law. That's the statute. Trademark infringement is covered. It is one of the offenses. We have coverage for trademark infringement. That's, I mean, you know, you could, in the old days, before trademark infringement was added, get to the same place by talking about misappropriation of advertising ideas and style of doing business, and, of course, reach the same result. And therefore, I assume that's why the law was changed. That's why the policy was changed to just say trademark infringement is advertising, is an advertising offense. So that if the complaint says you've confused the public about the source of the product, you've made them think that something that should be attributable to us is attributable to you, you have alleged an offense that is covered under trademark. That's why there was a similar case, the Curtis, I keep coming back to the Curtis case, I think it's a pretty good case, Judge Posner's case, applying Wisconsin law again, reversing the Judge Randa and the decision that counsel relied on in his brief, says that, you know, it isn't a question of magic words. It's not the legal label they claim there was at the time the language of the policy was unfair competition. And the insurance company said it doesn't say unfair competition in the complaint. And Judge Posner says what is important is not the legal label that the plaintiff attaches to the defendant's insured's conduct, but whether the conduct that's alleged in the complaint is at least arguably within one or more of the categories of wrongdoing that the policy covers. And then he goes on to say, nor is the insurer allowed to escape from his duties of defense and indemnification by reference to the core or dominant character of the plaintiff's allegations. That would violate the principle that if any of the conduct alleged in the complaint falls within the scope of the insurance policy, the insurer must defend.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Thank you, Mr. Croak, for your arguments today in a very interesting case on advertising injury, not one that this Court has faced before. Thank you. That concludes our argument in 01-2432, Fireman Fund versus Bradley. Thank you. The students will remain to listen to what